Hey, wait a second. It's the end of the week, isn't it?
It is. It's Friday.
Fantastic. You lose track of days, you know, when you're semi-retired.
You do?
Well, I do. I don't know about you.
No. Hey, come on.
Well, you're less retired than I am. It's McCowan. It's Shannon. We're going to talk to a couple of very prominent agents who both work for the same company, interestingly enough, but represent different clients. Although, it'll be interesting to find out exactly how much their job description actually overlaps, given that they work for the same company.
Right.
Judd Moldaver represents Austin Matthews. Jeff Jackson represents Connor McDavid. And we're going to chat with both of them.
And neither of them represent us.
Nobody represents us. That's right. Nobody wants to waste their time representing us.
3% of nothing is?
Nothing. Back with the agents after this message. Well, we are with two of the most prominent hockey agents in the business, and both of them are with the Wasserman Hockey Group. But they represent, I don't know whether you can say the two highest profile clients in the National Hockey League, but two of the highest
profile. Well, if you ask these two guys, they're going to tell you they're the two most high profile. Well,
and they may argue as to who is number one and who is number two. Judd Moldaver represents Austin Matthews. Jeff Jackson is responsible for Connor McDavid, and they join us on the program. Lots of ways we could start this thing, guys, but let me do this. We're talking about the agents for two of the highest profile guys in the business. But you also represent, I'm quite sure, players of significantly lower stature. When you're in a contract negotiation, how different is it dealing with a guy who's a million-dollar player versus a guy who's a 10-plus million-dollar player? Judd, I'll throw it to you first.
Yeah, first of all, thanks for having us, guys. I think we take the approach every player is different based on their price structure or where they're at in their career. So in representing players that may not wear number 34 or 97 in this case, I think the approach is the same. What's important to them? Where's the fit? Are they a UFA? Are they an RFA? What's the relationship like with their organization? And as far as negotiating their contract, I think we put the same vigor and intensity in because our responsibility is the same. And of course, the dollar amounts are different. The terms might be different, but I think we take every negotiation with the same equal intensity and strategic thinking.
Jeff, it would be logical to assume that the bigger the name, the bigger the contract, the more complex the contract, and therefore that contract takes longer to execute under normal circumstances. Is that true?
Well, the structure in the NHL, the contracts are fairly straightforward. You can't really deviate too far from the standard player contract. So, and there's certain rules with respect to how much percentage of the total deal can be in signing bonus and things like that. But there's not a lot of leeway to have, a lot of different type of terms in these things. So although some big contracts are fairly straightforward and easy to negotiate in some ways, like Judd said, we do, just like lots of agents, we do our homework, we're prepared for it. It doesn't matter if it's Connor or, an entry-level player or a guy going into a second deal who's playing on the fourth line. I think we have to be super prepared to for the negotiation, and everyone's different. Every GM is a little different. Some guys are, some guys like deal with it themselves. Some have their assistant GM deal with it. Some take longer than others. And that's, my experience, it really doesn't matter if they're a high profile player or not. It just depends on the circumstance.
The interesting thing for me with both of you is that, and particularly with Austin and Connor, is there's obviously a level of competition between the players. Is there ever a level of competition between the agents, Jeff? Do you think that's there?
No, not within our firm. I think we got a very cohesive unit. We kind of, Team WAS is something that we use at our firm across the board in all the sports. And it's cliche, but it's actually very true the way that our company's, the hockey department at least, has been formed. It was Dave Gontney and I who originally joined through a purchase of a big chunk of Orr Hockey, and then Judd joined, and even the addition, recent additions of four or five more agents. Like what we're trying to do is have a collective approach where we use each other's experience and, you know, connections and everything else in the business to further our own clients. So yeah, there's no competition. Like Judd and I laugh and we talk every day. We talk to Dave Gagne every day. It's great. It's a great setup.
Well, Judd, how would you define the collaboration then?
Yeah, I think I echo Jax's statements. I think, you know, we're like a good team, right? I suppose to the degree that there's any competition, it would be healthy. Like with a good club, you're pushing each other, so to speak, in practice or things like that. But I think the collaboration's been top notch. Like Jax alluded to, you know, him and Gags have a longstanding relationship. And over the past almost 4 years, we've added a collection of agents with eclectic backgrounds geographically all over the world, which is all by design. And I think the collaboration's been awesome. You know, we share information, bounce ideas off one another. And I think that's the strength of our group, that we're really kind of pulling for each other. And I think our players feel that, where, you know, the responsibility may lie from one player, group of players may fall in the lap of one or two of people on the staff more. I think our players at Wasserman Hockey are feeling the overarching like collaboration, whether it's the contract negotiation, the off-ice endeavors. It really is a team WAS concept, and it's a family concept. So we're part of something special, and we're just getting started. So it's exciting.
When you talk about team WAS and away from the ice, Wasserman's not a small company. Let's face it. It's not just a hockey company. It's a massive corporation that has moved into the sports world. How does that help your clients improve their financial position?
And excitingly enough, we just added music recently. So the agency continues to kind of grow in different areas that complement one another. Look, for Jax and I and the rest of our group, our core responsibility is representing our hockey players, of which are at different ages and different stages and so on and so forth in their career. So helping them with their hockey endeavors, nutrition, training, all of the other accoutrements or, you know, resources that we and our group provides are first and foremost, because that's their goal, to be professional hockey players and sustain a career. And saying that, you know, there's opportunities for players off the ice. There's more cookie cutter deals or, you know, more traditional marketing deals, which can be exciting and fun to do and good opportunities for the players. Obviously, philanthropy is something our group thinks about and our players think about. And then finding those non-traditional opportunities, you know, for hockey to grow, I think players have to be exposed in a different way. And their main responsibility always has to be to their profession and performing. But those that can perform and tap into other opportunities, we feel more than equipped with the resources of the company, our know-how to tap into that for our players in a vast array of things that are connected to hockey and completely disconnected to hockey.
So I would assume that there is a significant amount of privileged, confidential information dialogue that is exchanged between the agent and the player during any kind of negotiation. Well, maybe all the time, but specifically during a negotiation. How much of that would be shared between you two guys? Like, Judd, how would you ever pick up the phone and call Jeff and say, you know, I got this situation and they're talking about this here. Is that kind of stuff happen?
Absolutely, Bob. And it happens fluidly. You know, it just kind of happens on the fly. So for sure, between Jeff and myself, the rest of our group, different group texts with 2-3 agents at the time, sometimes 5 agents, you know, so the answer is yes in a word, and it's a fluid thing. So for sure.
Ever have a client, Jeff, who is upset by that collaboration, by the fact that there's another agent who doesn't really represent that player, where information is being exchanged within your office?
No, I think the way that we've, you know, kind of positioned it is, and we can use any number of players. We can use Sam Gagne, we could use Connor McDavid, we could use Travis Dermott, we could use whoever, but they all know Judd. They all know Dave. Judd just had coffee with Connor when he was in Arizona last week. You know, they know we're part of a team. There's a relationship there. I know Austin really well. Judd and I work together on his contract. So I know the family. Like, we have this system, I guess, for lack of a better word, where we're interconnected with clients and you know, there's no doubt about it. Austin's agent is Judd, but we have, you know, I have a relationship with Austin and Connor has a relationship with Judd, and it goes throughout our client list and throughout our agent list.
Yeah. So how much, I'm just curious, because Jeff, I've known you since you were a player in the National Hockey League. Then you were an assistant general manager for the Maple Leafs. Judd, I got to know you through your previous association at CAA. You guys have come up from two different worlds to end up in the same agency world. How did you get to this point, Jeff? You first. How did you get to this point to figure out that this was the way that you can earn a living? And how did being a player and being a manager help you get there?
I can say that I never thought I was going to be an agent. I went, you know, when I finished playing, went to law school, then I practiced law on Bay Street in Toronto for 8 years, and I did entertainment law. And then I ended up finding my way to the Leaf job when John Ferguson hired me as the assistant GM. And I spent almost 5 years there. And when I left that job, I really didn't think about the agent thing either. And it just happened by chance. I got a call from Sam Gagne, who was, you know, I've known since the day he was born, and I'm good friends with Dave, and I helped him out with his deal, and then it just kind of snowballed, and I joined Nor Hockey in 2010 or 11. And when we got to the point where, you know, the world's changing very rapidly with content and social media and all the analytics that come with that stuff and leveraging that for marketing deals, like, we knew, at least I looked at it and said, we have to be with a company like Wasserman that gives you the resources, the capabilities, all the backup to be able to represent these players to the best of our ability. So when Judd joined, I knew of Judd. I admired his style from afar when I would observe him with players, his clients. And although we come from different backgrounds, I guess, Judd was a player. Judd played, you know, college hockey, and has been in the business a long time, has tons of knowledge, and we get along fantastically, and it's a good fit.
So from college hockey days, Judd, how did you get to this point?
Well, I want to thank my agent, Jeff Jackson. So to say that I was a player is a bit of a gross overstatement, but I'll take it. Thank you, Jax. I'll pay my full fee at the end of the month. Okay. No, I think I've mentioned this, don't mean to overuse the word, but the eclectic nature of the group. I mean, you mentioned Jeff's playing career, his management career, Gags, he played, he was in management. Marcus, Simo, our different colleagues across our group have had different experiences. For me, I didn't play at a particularly high level. I grew up in Toronto, as you two gentlemen know, was exposed to all the hockey mania and, you know, did have a chance to play in college and was exposed to the proverbial culture and just always wanted to do it. Lucky to come from great parents and my siblings and father in the legal world, and just always wanted to do it and got in more of, and the, you know, just a kid who interned and tried to learn the business from kind of the ground up and use whatever hockey knowledge I'd picked up in growing up in Toronto and going to play in Maine at a small school called Colby. And in saying that, I think that's the strength of our group. Like Jack said, we have great personal relationships across our group, across our company. We'll have a little different knowledge set. My path is a little different. I didn't play at a high level, wasn't a particularly good player. Haven't really ever been on the team side, but I think, you know, you want to know people, you want to understand people, and ultimately parents, families, players, they give us trust, right? And at whatever point we start to represent them, we're taking all of our knowledge as hockey people, as business people, as citizens of the planet to try and give guys great advice, right? And throughout that, there's different stages and guys need different things from us. But I think the strength of our group is we all come from a little different angle, but we have fun doing it, and it's why I think we're so strong.
So if you were at a job fair, and kids were coming up to ask you, Judd, to be an agent, what would you say your strength was in your relationship with your guys?
I think you just got to care. You know, you got to show guys you really care. I think guys, you know, it's hard to make the National Hockey League. It's really, really hard. There's a lot of good players. We're really fortunate to represent a lot of them. Tons of high-end players from Roman Josi, Werenski, Carter Hart, Ekblad, DeBrincat. You know, I'm not going to name every guy. So fellas, we love you all. We don't have time on the show, but I think it's caring. I mean, it'd be naive to try and represent people if you weren't qualified to do as such. So to us, it's we can negotiate contracts. We can provide great off-ice strategy and nutrition and training. We have endless resources, and that's all great, and we're very proud of it. At the end of the day, I think it's guys want to feel like you care, you're there for them, ups and downs, and it's not just calling when you have something for them, but you know what's going on, and yet they have a consistent support system. I think that, to me, is what separates us.
It's a bit like, you know, again, I come from a player background, so I kind of still think through that lens with everything I do, and they got to know you've got their back, just like your teammates have to know that you got their back on the ice or off the ice or wherever. And that's the way we approach it. And that's always been my thing with my clients in particular, is just like, they know that if they need me, they're going to get me and I'll be there in a heartbeat. And, you know, you have daily conversations and texts and all kinds of stuff, but like when things get a little wonky, like, you're there. You kind of anticipate it ahead of time, just like a teammate would anticipate something, and then you know you're there. That's my approach anyway.
So how many clients do each of you have? Like what kind of numbers are we talking about,
Jeff? Well, it varies because we've got NHL guys, American League guys, junior guys, and then you're down into minor hockey because we recruit kids, you know, at a very young age. So yeah. and to me, what I would focus on the pro guys. We still have lots of touches with the junior players. But it's in the neighborhood of 20 guys. And I have, you know, support from Dave Gagne on some, I support him on some. We've got staff that does a lot of work with the players that on things that I don't need to necessarily be involved with. So it's a very manageable number. And that's kind of our whole thing, is we don't over recruit and we don't have a ton of players, so we can give each and every one of our guys like the attention they deserve. And that's never going to change as long as I'm at this place.
Judd, are you about the same? About the same number?
Yeah, I'm at about 15 guys, mostly pros, with two guys I'm sort of focused on coming up in the draft. But yeah, try and keep it lean, Bob, to give that focused attention. And Rachel Fite, one of our colleagues, is very involved in a lot of the players I'm sort of stewarding. You know, we hired an ex-player, Drew Shore, who comes from a kind of family of players. Nick Shore played in the NHL for a long time, as we know, and so have different support around it. But yeah, the I think that's what guys want, right? Like, I think all of our players understand that we're going to represent other guys. I think it's just guys feeling like their holistic career is tended to, and so yeah, those are the numbers that we're in, Bob, and I think it'll continue, like Jeff said, to be that way.
You talked about junior players. How much of a challenge has the last couple of years been, Jeff? You know, when you think about the OHL shut down for the season, the Q was played a sporadic season, so did the Western League. How much of a challenge was that for you?
It was tough because, you know, kids and their parents are getting antsy, and there's the odd player who went to play in Europe or whatever. And, you know, then it's all of a sudden it's like, why aren't we going to Europe? And, you know, we had explored different opportunities, and we didn't think the risk was worth the reward. In some cases, if you got caught over there, like, so much has changed in the last year as far as knowledge about the pandemic and things. But one of the fortunate things last year with our clients is we had a number of the junior guys who played in the American League, like Quinton Byfield and Jamie Drysdale and Luke Evangelista, Will Cooley, Ryan Suzuki, Connor McMichael. They all played in the American League. They were junior players. They would have been playing in the OHL. They couldn't, and they were allowed to play in the American League, which accelerated all of their development. And that's something that, you know, it's been discussed a lot about allowing players, and they're allowing it again this year to a certain extent, where those players who are elite don't have to go back to junior. So for us, it was a blessing that they were able to play in the American League, because we didn't have to worry about them and their development and losing an entire year. In fact, it accelerated it last year.
Well, it's intriguing to me when you're dealing with multiple players, that you're dealing with multiple personalities and multiple needs. For example, if you two guys were representing John and I, of course, he'd be calling you every 5 minutes and bitching and complaining about something, and you'd never hear from me because I'm just a good guy.
Hello. Hello.
that being the case, all right. Who's the most annoying client you've got? Oh, good luck getting an answer to this.
That doesn't exist. Are you looking for Bigfoot, Bob?
Well, all right. Who's the guy who calls you the most?
You're not going to get that answer.
I'm going to ask the question anyway. I don't care.
I don't think there really isn't an answer. I think you said it eloquently, Bob. I mean, every guy is a little different. Every client of every business is a little different. Some guys want to talk more, text more. I mean, it's hard to bottle up. It's the right fair question. I think, you know, there's certain sequences where a player is maybe going through a situation has no connotation, and therefore there maybe more chats are worthy, necessary. So I think it's there's different cadence depending on what's going on, but every guy's a little different, and we have no annoying clients, and nobody calls too much. We're here to service them whenever they need, and you too as well, but we're expensive, so get your pens sharp. Or
get 50% of nothing is still nothing. I got news for you. That's the way it's going so far.
But Judd, you know, I think there's a lot of people out there that assume that once you do the contract, that you don't have a management agreement with a player. That's not necessarily the case, is it?
That's beyond. It's a falsehood of the highest order. I think it'd be also inaccurate to deny that a player's playing contract is not usually their highest source of income and revenue, and where there's a lot of focus. Having said that, we pride ourselves, our group as a whole and our company, on, hey, we do that contract, but it's servicing the contract, the relationship with the team, with management, various things that go on in a player's career. There are injuries. There's all sorts of things that go on. So it's we want to earn our keep holistically, and then away from the hockey stuff, I think there's an understanding our players know we want to service them in all ways, and it's a much deeper relationship, and we're not transactional. I mean, it's a partnership really with our players. We collaborate, you know, Jeff and I and the rest of our team in the hockey group and beyond, and there's collaboration. I mean, with our players, you know, you ask us our philosophy, we're all a little different. Jeff and I have different styles, other guys, different age groups, different experiences, but I think we, you know, with our players through the client list, we're a partnership, right? Like, they're not successful and we're not successful unless we work together, right? So that includes everything in their career, and we want them to just focus and have fun. And that's the other thing we try to do. We try to have some fun, you know? The guys are playing a sport, they have pressure on them, but let's make it fun, because what's the point if it's stiff all the time?
Jeff, one of the things I'm always fascinated by, and Bob introduced you as one represents Connor and the other represents Austin, but there has to be a difference between a player that plays in Toronto, you know, the fourth largest media market in North America, and one that plays in Edmonton, that's at about 1 million people. Is there a difference, Jeff?
Well, I think the media in Edmonton is... they're pretty rabid for their team, and they're knowledgeable, and there's lots of ancillary, if you want to call it that, media, like social media people who weigh in. And that's one of the things now that we have to deal with. It's not just the traditional media. It's all, everybody's got an opinion. Everybody's a, you know, an analytics specialist. Everybody's writing grading reports on players after every game and all that stuff. So I think that, yeah, the market's different. But when you have a player like Connor, you know, the media attention on him, you know, you can turn on the highlights in Toronto and it's Sportsnet in Toronto, and they're talking about Connor, and his kind of footprint is wide. So, but he handles everything really well. He's getting better and better at it. You know, it's a tough gig when you're a young kid and you got to talk to the media every day, and you're a little bit, sometimes we've talked about it, John, like he, you know, he doesn't want to make mistakes in the media. He's always been very careful, and you can see now that he's very comfortable with himself and his role as a captain of that team and in front of the camera. And he does a great job. So I don't have a lot of worries about him at this point.
What about endorsements?
What about
No, just different between Edmonton and Toronto, or is it you just strictly think national all
they're
the time?
They're both national. Yeah. They have national recognition, right? And most of the endorsements that they're going to do are going to be of national scope, aren't they?
Yeah, Connor has one local deal. It's a Western Canada deal with a company called Go Auto, and it's a big, really big automotive group out there. They have, you know, dealerships across a bunch of provinces, but everything else is in a more national framework. So, and I think Judd, you're the same with Austin, right?
Yeah, I think it's similar. I mean, 97's in Canada, is Canadian, but his reach is obviously national and global. And Jackson, Connor and Adam have done an amazing job in that way. And Austin's interesting, as you guys know, because he plays in Toronto, but he's American and yet, you know, Mexican-American with his mom being from Mexico. So we're trying to look at him as global and national, but certainly in the Toronto market of where he plays, try and look at different opportunities that are maybe connected to the province of Ontario inside the city. But try and be selective and judicious with their brands for sure.
Actually, you bring up Austin's U.S. base. I mean, the Apple deal you did last year was as much U.S. based as it was Canadian, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was a couple of years ago we did an Apple. He shot the iPhone spot with Marner and did that commercial, and it turned out really well. And at the All-Star Game in San Jose, actually 97 and 34 did a little panel there, as you guys may recall. So, yeah, no, Austin's had an interesting portfolio. The Apple deal that occurred, different partnerships like, you know, Nike, CCM, part of Mars Blade, which is a roller company also with making ice holders, sweeter sort of technology company, Dreamwater, and amongst other partners like Fanatics and Upper Deck. So he's got a good portfolio, and some are inside Canada, some are global, some are exposed to the U.S., of course, and try and make it, you know, like any portfolio, a little bit varied, right? A little, you know, try and experiment, try and cater to, whether it's Austin or Connor, any of our players' interests, right? Health and wellness, automotive, philanthropy, and just curate it all. But again, with players of that magnitude, you know, like Bob said, and Bob doesn't call as much as you do. It's national, John. I mean, geez, listen to Bobcat a little bit more here.
please.
Let John relax for a second here, because I know he's obviously very upset by that comment. Let's take a quick break and we'll come back with more back after these messages. With Judd Moldaver and Jeff Jackson, two of the more prominent agents in the hockey world, there's a scene in the movie Tootsie you guys may be familiar with, where Dustin Hoffman goes in to talk to his agent, and the agent derides him by saying, "My job is to field offers." Well, yes, but no. From an endorsement standpoint, are you guys proactive or reactive more often than not? Jeff, to you first.
I think it depends on, again, on the player. With players like Connor and Austin, and we're talking a lot about them, but we have opportunities that come to us. There's certain things that we've, you know, Connor is interested in, or Austin's interested in, that we pursue. The one thing about Wasserman as a company is we have an entire marketing and sales department that looks for opportunities for athletes across all the sports, whether it's basketball.
Sure.
So, and we're interconnected with those guys. So, you know, they bring us opportunities for players throughout our client list, depending, you know, on geography and all kinds of things. And if any of our players come and say, you know, we love this brand, I love this brand, it's important to me for whatever reason, or charitable, like we go and we try to, you know, dig a little deeper and have a couple conversations and see what we can do with that particular brand.
Same for you, Judd?
Yeah, I think it's a combination. We're certainly lucky enough to get some incoming calls on certain guys, and yet constantly proactive in chasing deals, but finding out what's important to them, right? So that we're out there and we're calling brands, it's authentic, right? And our clients know we're calling, so that, you know, you're being more efficient in that process. So for sure.
How do you manage Europe that way? Because Roman Josi is a big name in Europe. How do you manage it?
Yeah, and credit to Roman. He's an owner of the Norcane Watch Company, which, you know, Mark Streit, a dear friend of his, obviously a excellent career in the NHL, a terrific person, and a friend of ours, and along with a friend of theirs from Switzerland, and he tapped into that company. He's done some stuff with On, which is a Swiss, you know, training and kind of athletic company. And when it comes to the European opportunities, you know, at present, Jeff and I aren't leading a ton of the European players, but in Roman's case, he's part owner of Bern, you know, recently had a baby and got married. So for him, it's been looking at things more broader, you know, for a lot of players, it's their time, right? So in his case, it's been looking at things like Europe in that regard, does a lot of philanthropy in Nashville. And I think over time, especially when the world opens up, there'll be more opportunity for him there.
You know, sure. both of you have talked in discussing about your client base. You've mentioned family so much, you know, whether it's Austin's parents or Roman's family or just dealing with parents as a whole. Jeff, where do families fit into all of this?
Well, I think really to say it succinctly is they become part of our family, or we become a part of theirs, because in most cases we start recruiting these kids, they're 14 or 15, and our relationship is primarily with the parents at that point. And it evolves as they get older and the players become more comfortable, you know, kind of talking without their parents. And then, but they're never out of the picture, nor should they be. They're an important part of most of the players' lives forever. And so we maintain relationships with all the parents, and it gets less and less as they get older, but you know, there's still conversations. We see them at games. We see them, you know, we talk to them on the phone and text, and you know, anytime they need something, they can ask us, they know that. So it remains that way, but it kind of starts when they're super young and they're our primary contact with the kid.
One of the issues that an agent has to deal with is investment management, money management over the course of a player's career. I assume you have a whole division at Wasserman to handle that kind of stuff, or do you do it to yourselves?
We don't touch their money. That's one thing. We don't have a financial group. I've never believed in it.
Why?
Because it's not our expertise. It's not something that our job is to maximize players' careers, both from an earning and performance perspective, to the extent we can. And we make sure that they're taken care of with, you know, very competent, experienced, high integrity people, but they're third parties. Because at the end of the day, like, we don't want to get wrapped up in our players' monies. That's for the professionals to do it. People who have long experience and we trust, because they have a track record. That's our approach.
So, I understand. It makes a lot of sense to me, but you would understand some people will be surprised by that approach, because there's a potential economic benefit to Wasserman by having a division who would do all that kind of stuff, correct?
Yeah, and there's also like a big downside risk.
Well, sure.
Yeah. And you know, like, you can look, my former partner Bobby Orr, you know, went through a lot of stuff over his career, and it's time and time again you hear these horror stories of players with, you know, their agent or their financial advisor, and we don't want to be in the middle of it. We don't need to be. We have lots of other things that we need to take care of, and we make sure, like I said, that they're set up with really good people. We have tons of dialogue with those people ourselves, just to maintain, like, you know, an inside view of things, but we don't handle the money.
Look, our revenue's in two buckets, right? It's commercializing, marketing, endorsements, and what we do off the ice in bucket A, and bucket B is their playing contract. So there is no bucket C, really, and it's best served that way. And for us, you know, not to be too philosophical, because that can be boring, and I'm not qualified to be a philosopher or make all these wild analogies, but in some ways, you know, we see ourselves as the CEO of our player's career, and talking about their family and the player are sort of the board of directors, if you will. And what does any good CEO do? Well, they communicate with their CMO, their COO, and their CFO, as it may be. In our little, or my silly little paradigm, which I know makes Jax and the crew laugh with my analogies, you know, the CFO is outside the walls of Wasserman, but we work in concert and consistently with them, because to appropriately represent and guide players, you have to be, you know, interconnected with all the parts of their career. So we're certainly instrumental in making introductions where appropriate, whether it's in the FA world or otherwise. But again, are pretty surgical and precise as to the monies we go after for our players, how we make revenue, and what our role is. And a lot of it is to make sure everything's happening as it should be.
So one of the things that I think that you'd both agree to is that so much of success away from the game is exposure and being exposed. Judd, what does a new television contract in the United States with ESPN and Turner do for your clients?
Oh, it's awesome. I mean, it was really exciting to hear, you know, those two networks and platforms be, you know, back in the hockey world. And I think for all of our players, you know, Austin, as you guys may have saw, was on the cover of ESPN, and it was a really turned out to be a great piece and a great shoot. And, you know, when I was mentioning, I think, I don't know, Jax, it was you and I talking the other day, there's so many conversations all the time about this stuff, but you know, just being somewhere where I wouldn't have otherwise probably seen hockey on the TV, and knowing that ESPN's in every restaurant, airport, everywhere, you know, that unto itself, I think, has been phenomenal because of the brand that ESPN is. And TNT, you know, I'm a basketball fan. I love the NBA. Nobody wants to see me shoot a basketball, but certainly watching what they've done to make, you know, like you're saying, John, away from the game, that show with Charles Barkley and Shaq and the rest of the crew there has been awesome. So I think the people that they've hired at TNT too, and having that kind of visibility and maybe having an audience that flicks to TNT that aren't otherwise hockey fans are now maybe getting exposed to hockey all of a sudden, just because that's a network they go to for other content. So I think it's a win not only for our clients, but for all players, because it's just great exposure. So really exciting.
No, it's interesting because I think that there's lots of people that live in the U.S. that think those brands are going to help. But you're also going to have to be patient with it, don't you think? Because it's not going to happen overnight.
No, it's a chestnut checkers, right? So there's got to be some degree of patience. We're all still living in a pandemic world, which there seems to be, you know, a lot of more questions than answers. And so, like all good things take time, but it appears that both broadcasts have been off to a good start, and it's exciting to see. So I think it's been real positive.
So I know you guys won't, I was going to say without mentioning names, but you wouldn't mention names anyway. So it's an irrelevant point. I assume there have been scenarios whereby you guys are maybe in a contract negotiation with a player and a team, and you reach a point where you think you have had success in your negotiation and you're probably at or very close to the end of that negotiation. And then the player has said, well, hell, I'm worth a million more than that. How do you, I assume that's happened. You're shaking your head, Jeff. No, never?
No, because these guys are intimately involved. Like, we don't just go off for a month or two and do a deal and come back and say, hey, I got you this. Like, it's kind of right from the preparation stage right through. The way we do it is the player is, you know, kind of getting blow by blow. And sometimes we protect them if it's during the season and they're playing, you know, it may be less communication, but they still know what's going on. So there would never be a point where we would be put in a position where, what are you talking about? That's not enough for me. They know exactly where the target is, where we're at, and they have to be super comfortable. In fact, they have to sign off on what the deal is before we would ever say to the team, like, okay, we're there.
Sure.
So, Judd, I know, you know, you and I have done a couple of negotiations together, like on Yost and Austin, where everybody in the family, the players, their wives, Roman was just married, but everybody knew what was going on all the time. And so you get to the end and you can, you know, with confidence say, okay, we're good. Because we know what the answer of the player is when we call them and just confirm it.
Yeah, absolutely. The preparation is everything. And echoing Jax, from the inception, we're connected. So, you know, this summer, Werenski's deal, Jake Bean, Carter Hart, in touch with them all the way through. And in Jake's case, he was traded. Had a different scenario. You know, Zach was in his own situation. Carter was in his own situation. And yeah, like Jeff said, we don't do things and then report back. It's a partnership. And in any good partnership, you're in real time with the communication. So there's no surprises, and you're, you know, advocating and you have clear direction as to what you're trying to accomplish, and they know what we think. And so, yeah, I would agree emphatically. We're never in that situation, and we usually get a good result, and fortuitously our players trust us enough to work with us in that regard. So
Judd, not to put you on the spot, but have teams changed their negotiation styles? Is it different now than when you started?
It's crazy. I think so. I mean, shoot, I'm going to be 41 in 3 months, John. I'm getting old on you. And I've been doing this job since I've been 23. And so I think in some ways it has, never mind the CBA is changing and, you know, society changed, but certainly GMs change. The culture changes a little bit. So I think in a word, yes. I think also as earlier, I think Jeff may have mentioned, I mean, every management team is a little bit different, right? And so you kind of go about it, I think, uniquely to the situation.
But is there a way to pinpoint how teams have changed their style? I mean, are they more analytical?
I think it depends on the team. I think for sure we all know analytics have played, you know, have come on the scene in all sports and hockey and have been front and center. I think, you know, every team's a little different for sure. I think analytics are, you know, a wave that runs through 32 clubs and in perhaps different depths. So I don't know if it's one thing for me to pinpoint. I think things have changed over time. I think the bottom line is every negotiation is its own negotiation. And even if you're, you know, doing a deal with the same manager, it's two different players. They could be the same time. They could be months apart. So to me, it's not a specific pinpoint. It's a good question. I personally just don't have a precise answer except to say yes. And our job is to work in the specific case and navigate it or stick handle through it as best as we can.
Jeff, you used to do negotiations on the other side. Has your philosophy changed?
No, not really. I mean, I still take the same approach as I took when I was, you know, doing it in Toronto for the Leafs. Is I try to prep my case and know exactly the range of the number that I want to be in, and then I work toward it. And I usually don't play like high low with anybody. Even on this side, it's more like we have an initial conversation. You get a feel for where people are at, and then you just work towards getting a deal done. I haven't had a contract negotiation in the NHL on either side where it gets weird or people get pissed off, or you get a resolution that everybody's a little bit happy and everybody's a little bit pissed off. That's the main thing. And then your client will be happy. So yeah, I take the same approach. I think the question you asked Judd is, there's a team of people now on the teams. Like when I was working with Toronto, it was myself and I did the research myself, and Fergie and I would talk, or Berkey and I would talk, or whoever was the GM at the time, Cliff, and we would go about doing the negotiations. You know, now just based on the conversation, there's a whole whack of people behind the scenes running numbers and confirming in real time whether you're telling the truth or not. Like you can get that sense of like, you better know your stuff or they're going to call you on it. Mm-hmm.
Are you surprised there aren't any more offer sheets?
What was that?
Are you surprised there aren't more offer sheets?
Offer sheets are obviously a negotiated tool. It's in there. I think everybody's a little bit wary of them. I think the one that got done this last summer could be something that is instructive for teams and agents, you know, doing a one-year deal, something really different for an offer sheet. So we'll see. We'll see what happens going forward. It was very unique. He was our client. So Judd and I weren't involved in it. Marcus Leto and Simo were with Kotkaniemi, but it'll be interesting to see if it changes because of that one-year deal and the way that played out.
Again, no secrets to be divulged, but you walk in the beginning of a negotiation for a player, the GM says, this is all I got. I got this much because of cap reasons, because of that. What's the pat answer? What's the pat response? knowing that this thing is going to be, this discussion is going to go on for weeks, probably.
Depends on the player, eh, Judd? Like, I mean, we hear that because of cap's been flat, we've been hearing that a lot in the last couple of years, right? And it's all, we got no money and I only have this in my budget. And our response is always, well, you know, it's your job to manage the cap, so figure it out. Like, there's ways to do it. I won't name names, but one of our negotiations, I kept getting this, like, you got to help me. You got to help me. I was like, I managed a cap for 5 years. I don't do that anymore. That's your job. So like, you know, it's one of those where that's not our job. And if we believe our player is worth X and it doesn't fit their puzzle right now, if you really want the player, you're going to figure it out one way or the other. And there's not a lot of flexibility in the system. I mean, LTI has provided some flexibility with teams, but other than that, there's not a lot of wiggle room, so you got to move bodies out, which is hard to do.
Last one for me. I don't know about Shannon, but I've said this on many occasions. You ask almost any hockey person who the most valuable player on a team is, and they'll say it's the goaltender. You can't win without.
Oh no! Here we go. Here we go.
I don't think there's a position in the NHL that's more underpaid than goaltenders. Goaltenders are rarely drafted at the top of the first round. How can a position that's so important in the game be so poorly compensated for? Or do you guys disagree? Do you not represent any goaltenders, for example? Judd, you want to take a shot at that? Oh, Judd's frozen for
He's
the moment.
Frozen.
Away, Jeff.
Well, I'll jump in until he unfreezes. Yeah, I mean, it is true. Like, you know, you don't win without good goaltending. But the thing with goaltenders is, you know, typically they – mature in the position a little bit older. And so they, you know, yeah, you'll see it every year in the draft. Like, people are hesitant to take them too early because they're not going to play for a while unless they're unique or a unicorn. But as soon as the first goaltender is taken, then all of a sudden, you know, everybody starts drafting goalies. Everybody's got them on their list, but it's kind of like, as soon as the first one goes, you know, other teams jump in. I mean, Carey Price he makes $10 million a year. He's well paid. There's a number of goalies that are, you know, Bobrovsky's in the $9.5 million, I think he makes. And, you know, if your goalie doesn't play well, and there's goalies who are super, you know, elite goalies who have off seasons, you know, they just don't play well for whatever reason. So I don't know why typically they're not paid more, but they're not paid more early because there's this, like, you know, long development track typically.
Well, every yeah. goalie, okay. I got cut off there for a sec. Every goalie we represent is a difference maker. That's for sure. So I would say to go back to what Jeff said, yes, the offer sheet's an available tool. I'd also earmark that. But I think at any given time, any positional player can be impactful, right? It depends on the makeup of a team. Some teams are stronger in their forward group and some in their defensive group, some have strong goaltending, strong forward group, and maybe their D group is their the third best of their, you know, positional sets. So I think whether, you know, goalies will continue to earn more and more as the market moves up. And as far as a hard cap goes, you know, there is no cap when it comes to top players. They should be paid accordingly. And we want to be sensitive. All of our players want to win, but it's not our problem. Without being empathetic to it.
Yeah, well, so
we got to go. So this better be quick.
Quick question: Have you warned all your clients with your long term deals that their escrow is going to be really bad at the end of this CBA? And what do you tell them?
Well, I mean, the escrow for now is a cascading downward slide anyway, which was negotiated, and for the deals that we've done since the new CBA came along. We've backloaded them in structure, so they're making more money on the back end of it. And look, we hope that revenues will grow, the game will grow, the world will get to a healthier place, and escrow becomes a moot point. And I wish we were Nostradamus, but we're not. So it's incumbent upon everyone involved in hockey to grow the game and make the money so that escrow becomes invisible.
Guys, most fascinating conversation. We thank you very much for your time, and hopefully somewhere down the road we'll have a chance to four of us to sit down and chat some more about some other stuff in this area. Thanks a lot. Best of luck. Happy holidays too coming up.
Thanks for having us, and same to you guys.
Same to you, gentlemen. Take care. Thanks, guys.
We'll come back with more after these messages. And we're back. So our thanks to Judd Muldaver and Jeff Jackson for joining us on the program. Did you learn anything?
These guys are, you know, it's interesting. General managers are usually diplomats. The commissioner's a diplomat. agents are diplomats too, because if you talk too much about Connor McDavid or Austin Matthews, Roman Josi or Quentin Byfield's family might call you. They try to be as diplomatic as possible because they represent so many different groups. I mean, between the two of them, about 35 players and 35 families, right? And 35 families.
Well, you know what occurred to me in the middle of our conversation today is, because we've interviewed many agents over the years, probably every high-profile agent, or just about every high-profile agent that's come through hockey for sure and sports in general. But so often we talk to them about other things other than what they do for a living. Mm-hmm. We talk to them about CBA negotiations or big picture stuff.
Right.
And not so much about, you know, the day-to-day business of being an agent.
Well, and one of the things that tweaked the producer to book these guys was after the discussion we had with Pat Brisson about the depth that he goes to represent players and the involvement he had in the Jack Eichel trade. And it took him 3.5 weeks to get up to speed to know anything more about spinal issues. And so these guys are on call 24/7. You heard that, is that they have to answer calls. It's a pressure packed job. There's lots of residual positives out of it, but sometimes thankless. So it was interesting to hear them talk about it.
Yeah, no disrespect intended, but I'd love to get a truthful answer to a few questions. Like, of the number of phone calls that you will get in a month from a player, how many are actually from the player and how many are from his wife?
Early on, their mother or father.
Or mom and dad. Right. Yeah, and of early course, on. There have been many high-profile players who have been highly criticized publicly because their parents were so intimately involved in their lives.
Carl Lindos so, online too.
That's one of the ones I was thinking of. We got to get out of here. That is all the time for today, all the time for this week. Shannon, have a nice weekend.
Yeah, you too, Bob.
And to our audience, the same. And we'll catch you Monday if the crick don't rise. Goodbye, everybody.